If you set high goals, make sure they are fueled by a passion for the journey. No great achievement ever comes easily, so you have to love the hard work you're going to have to put in along the way. If not, the pursuit will be a futile one. There are lots of people out there who see the images of the beautiful and picturesque country and the pictures of the trophy animals, who watch the videos chronicling these hunts, and who read the articles about these life-changing adventures. They tell themselves and others, "This is what I've always wanted to do." But a 10-minute video of a hunt or a 2,000-word article cannot do justice to a 10-day hunt. All you're seeing are the highlights. And in the highlights, chances are you're missing the blood, sweat, and tears. Doing a hunt by yourself means a hunt starts and ends with you. You have to do the research, pore over the details of the maps, test the gear, scout the country, and find the animals, all before finally tasting success if, and only if, that arrow strikes home. Before making that kill, the time in the country is full of silence, bouts of homesickness, and likely second-guessing the decision to take in such a monumental challenge. Endless hiking in rugged and unforgiving country, with the sun beating down on you, or the wind drying your face, cracking your lips, or maybe your fire for the hunt being literally and figuratively doused by rain while looking for an animal, can end up producing doubts and fears inside of you. And that's just during the day. The nights are obviously darker, but can be an even greater test to the wandering mind and loneliness. The question ultimately becomes, do you love hunting enough to endure? The backcountry can defeat guys who aren't more than physically fit because mentally, after a couple of days on their own, without any distractions of normal life, they become wrecks. What is your lifelong ambition? What is your long-term goal? Whatever it might be, whether it's becoming a solo backcountry hunter, or a doctor, or a musician, just know that all rewards have to be earned the hard way. There are no shortcuts to success in the mountains and in life. Those who work the hardest are successful, period. Get to work. Elk Hunter Special by Jim Osborne. Look forward all summer to this time of year, loaded the truck and bought a little beer. Pull into camp under beautiful skies, set up the tent and start telling lies. Cut and stack the wood and everything's a go. Scout a few elk and it's looking like snow. Well, the fun's all over, and the work starts here. Gotta get out your knife and put down your beer. Didn't fire a round, but packed meat all day. All I got stories of the one that got away. Whether it's the time you got the rack or the year of the big snow, you got some good memories and a few pictures to show. Well, when it's all over, you got an elk or not, you start planning next year to give it another shot. This poem was written by the late Jimmy Osborne, a friend who grew up with me and my brother Pete. The three of us, along with Jeff Peck and Donnie Manila, all grew up on Windland Road in Marcola, Oregon, and were the best of friends and fiercely competitive. Life in our high school days revolved around playing sports with a big emphasis on football. Playing football, Donnie and I were the connection because he was a quarterback and I was a wide receiver. We hooked up for a lot of touchdowns. Pete and Jimmy were a couple years younger and dubbed themselves the Connection 2, believing they were better than the original. Maybe they were. The point is we pretty much saw each other every single day for years and were very close. After high school, hunting took precedence over most everything. In the off-season, Jimmy and I went through a period where every weekend we'd ride horses into the country where we deer hunted. We'd load up our saddlebags and spend the entire day in the mountains trying to be like the man from Snowy River. I have a lot of great memories from those days. When Jim was killed in a freak accident on his horse at the age of 28, many were devastated, especially his wife Wendy and his three young kids, who he'd be very proud of if he could see them today. Jim has been gone for over 20 years now, but his memory lives on. A man taken in the prime of his life like Jim has always been hard for me to make sense of. I just know we need more guys like Jim Osborne. Tough, hardworking, loyal, and smart. Jim's poem here comes from his experiences at elk camp. I've always liked this poem as it allows me to envision the camaraderie and the tradition of an annual elk camp. My only elk hunting experiences have come by the way of bow and arrow, where solo hunting is the name of the game, or at least it has been for me. So I never got to spend a week at a big elk camp where hard mountain hunting ruled the day, and canvas tents, a wood stove, big meals, poker, and cold beer made the nights fun and memorable. If you have a friend like Jimmy Osborne, consider yourself lucky. Few people in life get to devote their full time to their passion. What will you sacrifice to continue to pursue your passion? Vacation time? Family time? Binge watching your favorite Netflix show? Show up, work, sacrifice, and achieve. Keep hammering. Easy sucks. Since my early, clueless days, I've enjoyed some elk hunting success, and along the way, I've learned that achievement often involves some blood, my own. Bow hunting is not easy, which is perfect. I despise easy. Easy does nothing for my spirit. Easy can't change my life. No one tells an epic story about an easy path they've traveled. That's why I love backcountry bow hunting. It's not easy. It's a powerful mental, physical, and spiritual journey. It is life-changing. Arrowing a big 6x6 bull in the mountains brings extraordinary satisfaction, but it's never going to be easy. You can get lucky once, but if you expect every year success like I do, you're going to have to work. Train hard, hunt easy. Means I want my training to be so hard, even the most difficult of hunts are easy by comparison. Long mountain runs make me dig deep in training and give me mental strength and physical endurance. Training hard is not easy. It'd be really easy not to run every day. It'd be really easy not to lift every day. It'd be really easy not to shoot my bow every day. Only problem, easy sucks. You don't wake up and see a new person in the mirror. There are no overnight transformations or dramatic improvements. Just little tweaks along the way. Nothing makes it easy, though. Everything I do is very hard. Bow hunting, running, lifting, no shortcuts in any of it. It just takes time and effort. Try to make training as hard as possible, and you will go a long way towards succeeding on those ball-busting hunts. I shoot my bow every day of the year anyway, but I believe the reps that really count are when I shoot after running an ultra or after a tough lifting session, when I'm beat down, tired, weak, and mentally exhausted, much like I get on those long mountain hunts. I know if I practice putting the arrow on its mark when feeling like this, I'll be that much more proficient come crunch time. People typically look for the easy way out, me included at times. The human body is capable of amazing things if we get out of our own way mentally. For those who say it's too much to hammer every day with all you have, I can't relate to that mindset, and I don't want to. Life ain't easy. Just gotta keep grinding. Chapter 6. Obsessed or Average? Most people won't give up all. I will. Get better and grow, or throw in the towel? These are two choices we're faced with on a daily basis. Sometimes growth might be something as simple as spontaneously deciding to go run outside in the rain, or might be some deep-rooted desire you've carried from your childhood. Hunting isn't the only thing I've been passionate about since I was a kid. A good elk steak is enough to inspire anyone, but the written word has always been a big inspiration to me as well. I grew up enamored with good writing, mostly as it pertained to hunting, but the subject didn't really matter. Words that could paint a picture fascinated me. I was never that good at writing, but I wanted to be, and I tried really hard. As I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite books is Hunting with the Bow and Arrow by Saxon Pope, with a special introduction by Fred Bear. My dad bought me the title on one of his many Salvation Army bargain searches. I buried myself in that book, and its images are burned deep in my mind. As a teenager, I bought and read every hunting magazine on the rack. I always loved the feel, smell, photos, and of course the words that filled good hunting magazines. I have framed magazine articles and filled albums with cutout magazine articles. I have full collections of hunting magazines, stacks that drive my wife crazy, that I could never dream of getting rid of. To me, they are an indelible part of history, my bow hunting heritage, if you will. As a kid, I would ease through the timber of Western Oregon and recall anecdotes my favorite hunting writer shared. This was a special time for me. All the magazines had great writers. I seemed to connect best with the articles in Bowhunter magazine. I was young, but to me it was the biggest, best, and most legit magazine out there. In the same way kids today are enamored with professional athletes, I looked up to my hunting idols. They were larger than life to me. In my dark living room back in the late 1980s, the TV flickered and emitted sounds of screaming bull elk as I watched my grainy Elk Fever VHS tape so many times that I could recite virtually every line Dwight Shue and Larry D. Jones spoke. I recall vividly the pine cones in the boot prank, as well as all the incredible bowhunting action. I bought green wool gloves like Dwight's and fleshed my arrows with red and white veins just as he did. I wore camo face paint with white and gray colors mixed in like Larry, and I've always submitted my hunting articles with my middle initial in the byline, just as Larry D. Jones did. Back then, M.R. James, the editor, ran the magazine I loved so much, and to a kid who bled bow hunting, he too was an influencing figure. I even wore a bandana around my neck when bow hunting during those early years, just as I'd seen M.R. do in many magazine articles. My infatuation wasn't limited to just my Bowhunter magazine idols. With my first few kills, I didn't smile at all, trying to emulate a big name in bowhunting at the time, Miles Keller. Of course, Chuck Adams was a bowhunting king, and I took great pride in the fact that he grew up hunting blacktails just as I did. For hometown heroes, the late Billy Cruz, founder of Oregon Bow and an elk hunting legend in Oregon's Eagle Cap Wilderness, was godlike to me. In my early years, Billy's amazing stories of his backcountry success in the same wilderness and exact same drainage as I bowhunted for big bulls inspired me to be tougher and to endure more than I ever would have otherwise. I started shooting an Oregon bow because of him, and I will never forget being featured in my first magazine advertisement for Oregon Bow. The passion I had for bowhunting governed my life in those days. Little has changed. I wrote my first hunting article back in 1990, published not long after my first bow season in 1989. I wrote a story called Bulls, Bugles, and Botches about the spike bull I killed my first season as a bowhunter after blowing my chance at a monster. I had everything in my own little world all figured out, or so I thought. Everybody needs feedback, but it's not always easy getting honest critiquing. Most people would read my stuff and say, "Hey, I think it sounds really good. Nice work." That drove me crazy because I knew it wasn't that great, but I couldn't put a finger on why. Carl Allen didn't mind giving it to me straight. I worked with him at the same warehouse where I met Trace. Carl was an interesting character in a workplace full of them. He and his wife would yell at each other over the warehouse intercom, and they threw trash cans at each other while working and squabbling. He was a hippie, a bit of a lunatic. He wasn't a hunter, but he's well-read and smart. I decided one day to have him read an article I wrote for Western Bowhunter. I knew writers wanted and needed feedback. You put your heart out there, so eventually you have to ask a question to somebody, "What do you think about my heart?" So I asked Carl if he'd read my article. Even though he couldn't relate to going into the wilderness to hunt for elk, he understood good writing. He read it and didn't offer up the cursory, "Good job." Instead, he asked, "When you are stalking the animal, what's it like? What noises do you hear? When you make steps, what do they sound like? Can you put me there? Can you let me know what it was like to be you in that moment? How you felt?" Carl's input was incredibly helpful. "I want to be there with you on the hunt," he said. "I want you to paint that picture with your words and put me there." I simply said, "Okay." Then I realized, oh my God, he's right. I've got to put people right there with me on these hunts. I need to let them know how it feels to stalk a buck with an arrow knocked, wind blowing gently on my face, assuring me my scent will make it to the deer before my arrow does. Carl's input gave me the insight and encouragement to dive deeper into my prose. I was so used to venturing farther into the wilderness when I was hunting, so I felt at home pushing deeper into my writing. Trying to do a better job on the details, trying to paint a better picture through words on the page. After finally receiving constructive criticism, the first step to improvement is acting on it. I was committed. I earned my stripes as a writer, penning many how-to articles along with editing a hunting magazine, Eastman's Bowhunting Journal. But all I really wanted to do was write hunting adventure pieces because as a reader, that's what I loved. The magazine business required technical writings and how-tos, but honestly, I was fully vested only when I was writing of grand undertakings. So before I worked for Eastman's, I tried to go big. To aptly write of grand adventure, one must be a talented writer. And as I've done most of my life, I had put the cart before the horse. To me, the best first step to launching my writing career was to get an article published in the very best bowhunting magazine in the world, Bowhunter. So after having a good season back in 1994, which included arrowing two Pope and Young Blacktail bucks, I put a manuscript package together and sent it off to M.R. James. I was excited about my first potential bowhunting feature. A few weeks after sending my article to M.R., I started calling home every day from work, asking Tracy if anything came in the mail from the magazine. Day after day, I got the same response from my wife. Nope, Cam, nothing today. Then one day, a couple months later, it finally happened. I remember it as if it were yesterday. After heading upstairs to the lunchroom of the warehouse for my afternoon break, I dialed home. Tracy answered the phone and said, "You got something from Bowhunter?" With butterflies in my stomach, I told her to open it. I heard ripping and tearing, the phone banging around, and then Tracy said I got a letter and some other stuff from somebody named M.R. James. She started reading the note. "Dear Cameron, thanks for sending me your bonus bucks manuscript. Congratulations on taking a couple fine bowhunting trophies. I'm returning your article and photos along with an invitation to rewrite and resubmit it." A full page of great advice followed this, and the letter ultimately concluded with these sentences. "Rewrite your article and try us again. You do have the makings of a good deer article, but it's going to take some effort to get this ready for publication in Bowhunter. Good luck, and give a shout if you need some specific editorial advice. Sincerely, M.R. James." Well, after Tracy read me the second sentence, I knew where the letter was headed. I was crushed. Since killing my first deer at age 15 and writing a story about it in English class, I'd held the dream of being an outdoors writer. Now my dreams were shattered. Rewrite and resubmit? I didn't want to rewrite anything. I had worked very hard on that article, poured my heart and soul into it, and I knew every single word was just right. With an "I'll show you" attitude, I bitterly sent the article unchanged to a local hunting magazine, which published it and sent me a big fat check for $25. Truth is, that was about $25 more than the article was worth. My article was nothing more than a hunting story about a guy who got lucky and killed two good bucks. It didn't teach the reader anything, and it didn't offer any powerful insights or share any poignant lessons. While at the time I was angry and frustrated, MR was right. My article wasn't up to Bowhunter standards. However, this sour disappointment was necessary to my development as a writer. I took a chance and was faced with either getting better and growing or throwing in the towel. I chose to keep hammering. What are you willing to sacrifice? In order to achieve anything in this life, you have to make sacrifices. Not just the typical ones we think about, such as money and time. Sometimes you sacrifice your emotional energy or others' trust and belief in you, all for the sake of a dream. The dreams of one individual are never identical to another. The British scholar, writer, and soldier, T.E. Lawrence, also known as Lawrence of Arabia, once said this about dreams: "All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night, in the dusty recesses of their minds, wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible." The only way to make dreams possible is to sacrifice. Back in the mid-1990s, when nobody knew me, I was writing for a magazine called Western Bowhunter for free. Being a writer was all I wanted to be, but I wasn't really one. When Doug Walker, the editor of Western Bowhunter magazine, asked if I wanted to go on a writer's hunt he was setting up, I decided to participate, even though it would cost me about $3,000. At the time, I had no business traveling to Bohunt, but I didn't care. My dreams are bigger than my abilities and definitely my finances. At the time, we were poor. We just welcomed our first child, Tanner, into our family. So Trace was off for 6 weeks on maternity leave while I was earning around $12 an hour. We were on a nutritional food program known as WIC during those 6 weeks until Trace went back to work. Spending $300 would have been a stretch, but $3,000? That would have been, and was, ludicrous. One part of me knew this was an opportunity, but another part told me I would never be getting that money back. Even if I got paid $25 per article, which I did when I wrote for Oregon Hunter, how many articles would I need to write to earn back $3,000? How many articles is that per year? I was only hunting in Oregon at the time, so how many articles would I really be writing? I didn't have to be a genius to know that the math on this looked bad. After my in-laws gave me $200 towards a hunt, I decided to put the rest on my credit card and consider it a business investment. I could use this hunt as an opportunity to earn a name and start selling hunting articles to pay the monthly credit card payment. It would take only about 10 years to get the hunt paid off. Ah, to be young and full of unrealistic dreams. Yeah, for the short term, I realized it was a pretty terrible decision. In the end, I worked as many hours as I could at the warehouse I was employed at, sometimes up to 16 hours a day, just to pay off that hunt. I spent probably 100 times more money than I ever made being a hunting writer until I wrote my books. I remember the hunt in great detail. It was on a great piece of land in Texas, the Y.O. Ranch, which was so big that kills qualified as free range, which isn't always typical in Texas. For what I paid, I could kill two white-tailed deer. One was just a small 8-point, the other was a management 7-point buck. But I went on the trip, and I never regretted it. This is the sort of mentality you have to have. Are you willing to take a chance on yourself? Are you willing and able to be stupid like that? I knew it wasn't a smart thing to do, but I did stuff like this often, and I would justify it to myself that someday it would pay off. I didn't obsess about whether I would be getting my money back and how quickly I would get it. I didn't question where this was going to put me. My mentality was to go, to believe, to take a chance, to be foolhardy and try over and over again. Obsession is lonely. For 33 Septembers now, bow hunting has been my obsession. Some people will look at me and talk shit. They have no clue about the sacrifices and struggles I've made for decades. I've learned that the people who talk the most won't sacrifice what I have, and those who will don't talk shit because they get it. All I know is you don't need anyone to believe in your dream. With tunnel vision focus, you can be whatever you want to be. I am a writer, and when I document something, it becomes part of my personal archives. I like writing when the feelings of success, failure, pain, or victory are fresh, so that my words are the most accurate and poignant. I don't want time to water down whatever experiences I'm trying to capture. I'm also somebody that can only give 100% at anything I do. Either I'm going to give 100% or I'm going to give zero. I'm never going to do anything halfway. These two traits came together when I decided to write my first book, Bowhunting Trophy Blacktail. There was never any grand plan. One day I decided I wanted to write a book, and I wanted it to be badass, hardback and full color. Nobody had ever done a book about bowhunting blacktail, so that's what I set out to do. That was as far as it went. How much would it cost? I figured it out, then priced up how much it would cost to print them and what I should charge for each copy. It turned out to cost $50,000 to print 5,000 copies. That was about $50,000 more than I had. I decided to go ahead and publish a book anyway. I had to borrow money from my whole family. My grandma Ruby, as the biggest investor, ended up giving me around $15,000. Was this a stupid decision to go ahead with a full-color hardcover book? Yeah. But I paid everybody back, including my grandma. When I did, she was so shocked that I gave her the money. She never had anybody in her family pay her back because, unfortunately, that's usually how family works. It's always like, yeah, I'll pay you back, but then things come up. But paying off my debt is exactly what I did. I've always been somebody who's going to do what I say. The only thing I ask is that others live up to their end of the bargain, no matter what it might be. It took me a long time, but I sold all 5,000 copies of Bowhunting Trophy Blacktail. For a long time, we had lots of cases of books in the house. I even had to move them once to a new house. I didn't really think things through before publishing it, and that's why it wasn't that profitable. I didn't sit down with a business plan or anything like that. I just had a belief and a determination that I needed to write and self-publish that book. By the time I wrote my second book, Backcountry Bowhunting, in 2005, I had a bigger name and a publisher, and that particular title blew up. It is now in its 9th printing and has sold 90,000 copies. Those two books represented two more big chances I took on myself, and not just in the field of bowhunting, but in my other passion of writing. It took me 20 years to finally earn a few pages in Bowhunter. After 20 long, hard years, I finally had a featured column, Bleed, in the September 2009 issue, complete with the byline, Cameron R. Haynes, listed in the table of contents. During those two decades, I wrote hundreds of magazine articles, authored two books, served as editor of a bowhunting magazine for 10 years, honed my bowhunting skills and writing skills, and worked my hardest to raise three kids as best I can, all with the unwavering support of my wife, Tracy. And now, coming full circle on this odyssey, I was finally blessed with the chance to write a regular column for my favorite bowhunting magazine. Bowhunting has made me who I am today. When I think of bowhunting, I think of hiking up faint pack trails in the wilderness that lead me to lonely, rugged mountains. Nothing about the backcountry hunts I love is easy. In my world, bowhunting will make you want to cry at times, have you dripping with sweat more often than not, and will probably require you to bleed a little for success. Not long ago, I was going through some things in my office at work and happened upon a flyer Easton's made to promote my book, Backcountry Bowhunting. I looked it over, and a couple of thoughts came to mind as I read the personal endorsements my book garnered from icons. First, I bet there's some on social media these days who might not know Chuck Adams, Mike Eastman, Randy Ulmer, or Dwight Schrute. They are all hunting legends and were my heroes growing up, learning the ropes as a bow hunter and writer. They paved the way for many in the hunting industry and made a huge impact on me personally. In the mountains stalking, arrow at the ready, eye scanning, I would think of Chuck Adams and the Sitka blacktails he'd hunt in late summer on Kodiak Island. Or that famous photo of him with his giant bow-killed brown bear. I think of his beanie, his smile, and by today's standard, the seemingly gigantic aluminum arrows. I wanted to be Chuck Adams. His tunnel vision focus was something I tried to emulate. I didn't have deep pockets, and I was very green to bow hunting, but I made up for it with effort. I learned more than 30 years ago that with extraordinary effort, I could experience above-average results when hunting. Hunters like Chuck Adams and Randy Ulmer simply set the bar for exceptional bow hunting. I read their articles and studied their photos for years, longing for the experiences they lived. I still do. Mike Eastman believed in me when few others did. He gave me a career-altering opportunity when he offered me a job at Eastman's. The late Dwight Schrute showed me what the power of the pen meant. His writing inspired me for decades. And as great a writer as he was even a better man. I was honored to have known him. The second thought I had was how the kind and complimentary words they wrote about me in my book seemed surreal when this flyer came out. They still do, even today. One thing I've noticed is that sometimes jealousy and envy permeate and taint the outdoor industry. Instead of building each other up and becoming a stronger group of unified, passionate, and focused hunters with a common interest, our egos have us tearing one another down. With our low numbers, we can't really afford to segment ourselves. We need one another. What those four pioneers said about me as I fought to earn my way says a lot. They built me up and didn't have to. To me, this says so much about the men they are, and in my opinion, it goes a long way in explaining why they've cemented themselves as hunting, writing, and outdoor icons. I'm still humbled, honored, and appreciative that those legends helped lead the way for me. On December 10, 1962, John Steinbeck took the podium to receive the Nobel Prize in Literature for his realistic and imaginative writings, combining as they do sympathetic humor and keen social perception. His opening remarks made it clear that he felt a bit like an imposter by earning this prize. In my heart, there may be doubt that I deserve the Nobel Award over other men of letters who I hold in respect and reverence, but there's no question of my pleasure and pride in having it for myself. I have felt like an imposter myself, and that has forced me to work even harder at what I do. Running, training, hunting, even writing. I love another quote from Steinbeck. The writer is delegated to declare and to celebrate man's proven capacity for greatness of heart and spirit, for gallantry and defeat, for courage, compassion, and love. In the endless war against weakness and despair, these are the bright rally flags of hope and of emulation. I hold that a writer who does not believe in the perfectibility of man has no dedication nor any membership in literature. Steinbeck isn't referring to being perfect, but rather the journey and dedication to the pursuit of perfection. This reminds me of my own journey, my desire for perfection in bow hunting, my dreams for publishing stories about those adventures. This perfectibility of man reminds me of the first 100-mile endurance race I ran in 2009. I think of the passion I see in others and in watching the success others have. What is your dream? Mine is to be the perfect bow hunter. I want to be successful in every hunt and release a perfect arrow on every hunt that results in a quick and merciful death of the animals I pursue. I realize bow hunting probably isn't something one can master, but that's my goal. That was how my journey in running and training began to ramp up. Greatness only comes with grinding it out. Striving for perfection means you have to put everything you have into your dreams. It was time to truly become obsessed. What brings you fulfillment and a sense of purpose? Focus on that and foster a life built around it. Study your craft and spend time excelling in it, whatever it might be. Find others who share your passion and follow their footsteps. Love the journey and ignore thoughts of the finish line, as this is a race that never ends. Nobody cares. You make a good shot this season? Nobody cares. Work harder. You miss the season? Nobody cares. Work harder. You got a promotion at work? Nobody cares. Work harder. Your dog died. Nobody cares. Work harder. You won the Super Bowl. Nobody cares. Work harder. Your battery died. Nobody cares. Work harder. You couldn't finish the marathon. Nobody cares. Work harder. You won the marathon. Nobody cares. Work harder. You run to the monument at the top of Mount Pisgah. Nobody cares. Work harder. Nobody really cares about your goals. Nobody cares about your excuses for not achieving what you said you would or what you thought you deserved. You want people to care? Then do something special. Do something that people can't ignore, easily dismiss, or one-up. Recent success? Yesterday means nothing. Recent failure? Yesterday means nothing. Yesterday means nothing. Give all you have to today. Worry about tomorrow, tomorrow. What you've accomplished in the past means nothing. We don't rest on our laurels here. Time to work. You killed your first bull? Okay, now that I care about. Now work harder and build on that success. Chapter 7. Ramp it up. You have to wonder at times what you're doing out there. Over the years, I've given myself 1,000 reasons to keep running, but it always comes back to where it started. It comes down to self-satisfaction and a sense of achievement. Steve Prefontaine. Long endurance races can strip one down to their core, physically and mentally. But on the other side of the challenge is increased strength and confidence to overcome typical daily challenges, which after conquering an ultramarathon, don't seem all that daunting. You have to walk before you run. Years ago, hunting and running went together like oil and water. I ran to get in shape and knew it helped my hunting, but no one ever talked about exercise for the hunter. There surely was no huge athletic performance apparel outfit like Under Armour making the highest quality gear for the active hunter, and projecting to all who will listen, athletes hunt. I started running just for the test, just to push myself. Up to the year 2000, the most I'd ever run was a 10K. Then one time I entered a 7.3-mile race in Salem, Oregon, and guys thought I was crazy for running that far, just to get in shape to hunt the blacktail woods around home. Then I ran a half marathon, and then in 2003, I ran my first marathon and finished third overall. This was about the time I really began to notice that my physical condition could play a huge impact in the hunting woods. This is where I could improve my game. I might hike 20 miles or more in a single day during a hunt, so building endurance is crucial. Generally speaking, the better shape I was in, the easier success came. And I've really found no ceiling to this approach. I'm trying, though. Since that first marathon, I've competed in ultramarathons, and when in peak shape, just prior to bow season, I run at least 20 miles a day. I've ramped it up in an effort to gain not only physical, but mental strength, and has paid off with many years of consistent success. I love endurance running for many of the same reasons I love bow hunting. At times, both disciplines will push even the toughest of human beings to the brink. And over the long haul in both endeavors, justice has always served as the people who work the hardest and sacrifice the most reap the rewards. Trust me, however, when I say this wasn't easy. And believe me when I also state that if I did this, so can you. No matter where you start, you have to put in consistent work. I wasn't born a naturally good runner. Once upon a time, I struggled to run 3 miles. I know what it feels like. Before you can grind up to the top of a mountain, you have to first get up off the couch and start moving. So where do you start? As I'll say time and time again, I don't give advice. I just share what I do. And I know what I do is not for everybody. Maybe it's not for anybody else. That said, to see where your journey can take you, first you must start. My whole thing is I don't care what you do, if you run or hike, so long as you're simply walking and moving, it's all good. If you've never run, that's okay. Get outside and take a walk around your neighborhood. Go somewhere and do something simply to burn some calories and get your metabolism jacked up. Walk when you can, even if it's for just a half hour. You'll feel good doing that. In just a couple weeks of regularly going out to walk, you'll be pleasantly surprised to see how far you've come. Then start to incorporate some running. Walk for 5 minutes, run for 5. Walk for another 5, then run for 5. Slowly, you'll start running more. Walk for 5 minutes and run for 10, then walk for 5, run for 10. Soon you'll find yourself running for the entire time. Then you can throw some hills in there, but take things slowly. Not many people can run a hill. It's awesome if you can, but you don't start off heading uphill. I love nothing more than running the mountains, but I've built up to this. I see a lot of guys who begin running and then start up out of the gate too hard and then oftentimes get shin splints. Then they can't do anything. You are working muscles that you are normally not using in everyday life, and you have to develop them before going crazy. With running, you have to ease into it, and you've got to put in the time and effort. My running was an evolution. When I began to put in 50 miles a week, soon I could run a half marathon in under 1 hour and 20 minutes. After finishing third in my first marathon, I still didn't believe that I was talented or naturally gifted as a runner. I just knew that I worked really hard, and I could work even harder. There was no limit if I ramped it up. I am not blessed with insane talent. My secret is time, and I've been grinding for years to get where I'm at. During my first year in the woods with bow in hand, I figured it out real quickly. I remember thinking it was going to be completely impossible to get within bow range of a bull elk and get him on the ground with one of my arrows. No one told me that I'd feel utterly harmless in the elk-inhabited woods with my stick and string. I kept plugging away, though, and each day I learned. Day after day after day after day. Finally, with each passing day, I was starting to get it. And the effort paid off when I arrowed a spike bull elk after 18 straight days of bow hunting. The key to that success? Time. It took me nearly 3 weeks straight of elk hunting, every day a supreme effort, to take that young bull. But with something as difficult as bow hunting, nothing happens overnight. In terms of my ability, I'm probably 10 times a bow hunter now compared to then. The biggest reason for this is I'm never satisfied. I'm always trying to get better. Get in better shape, become a better shot, and a smarter hunter. This takes time. You can't expect results overnight like everyone does in this day and age of instant gratification. Of course, at the start, I expected those immediate results right away, like most do. That was just part of being young and dumb. I had a lot to learn. And as a famous Michelangelo quote goes, I am still learning. I always challenge myself and look for a bigger and tougher test. After realizing I could run in marathons, I began to look into ultramarathons. In 2005, I ran the McDonald Forest 50K, which is 32 miles. Once again, people in my little circle thought I was crazy, and while I was running, I had a few thoughts that they were right. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done up to that moment, and I vowed to never do it again. Of course, I regularly ran in the event in the years that followed. In 2007, I decided to run in the Bighorn Trail Run. In the 3 weeks before the race, I shared a daily day in the life on my blog where I showed how I had prepared for the big race. Here's an excerpt from 10 days before the race. 4 a.m., I am up, couldn't sleep. Shower, emails, eat cereal soaked in water, read the paper, check a couple forums, coffee on the way to work. On the way out the door, my wife had to remind me today is our 15th anniversary. Man, talk about having a pit in my stomach. Not saying I forgot, but it has been a very busy time. Supplements, multivitamin, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamineral green drink mix, and fish oil capsule. 6 a.m., work. Fire off 30 pull-ups right out of the gate. Feeling not so fresh yet this morning, it was a short night's sleep. 10 a.m., coffee and a whole wheat roll. 12 p.m., eat 2 chicken and black bean burritos, watermelon, 2 pieces of wheat bread with no butter that Tracy delivered, like every day. She's the best. Drink water. 4 p.m., get home and chill out with the kids, eat a little steak and whole wheat noodles, light meal. Take off on a run with the Spot Hog SDP site with wrap that I will drop off at the Bow Rack during my run. Wayne set up my Vectrix and Vectrix XL with a red, white, and blue custom string. I did shoot a couple times before heading home. Money through paper and 2 shots with the Vectrix. God, that is a sweet feeling. Run home. This is an easy 6 mile run altogether. Shoot the Vulcan 24 times before running out the door. Taking a handoff from Trace of a bowl full of noodles and steak as I go, I shovel it down on the way to the first of Tanner's 2 summer league basketball games. 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. Watch B-ball. Tanner played well. And work on the computer. Emails. Lots of emails to get back to. This daily blog has really stirred interest. I love it. I can talk about bow hunting and conditioning as it relates to bow hunting all day and night. It sure seems like more guys are wanting to do all they can to prepare themselves for the rigors of the backcountry these days. This will result in bow hunting effectiveness, and more success means a tradition of bow hunting grows. That is my number one objective. One thing I'd like to share in the space, do not think you need to go on 10, 20, or 80 mile runs to be a successful bow hunter. I do think the more you can do, the better off you'll be, especially in the mountains. That being said, many, many guys kill animals with their bows and don't run a step before season. For that matter, there are guys who arrow animals every year who dust it off their bows a week before the opener. The problem in keeping up that routine is that those guys might not kill anything for 5 or 10 more years. For the average guy, if you don't prepare your body and you don't practice, if you kill anything with the bow, it'll be in large part because of luck. Bow hunting is all about preparation. And my goal is to hopefully inspire guys to ramp up what they are currently doing to prepare. If you run 3 miles once a week, maybe this blog will motivate you to run 3 times a week. If you shoot your bow twice a week, maybe after reading this, you'll shoot 4 times a week. Look, I'm not saying what I do, you should too. I am saying whatever we have called the norm, we can do more. That is me, you, everyone. Do this and bow hunting wins. Again, success and sharing positive experiences grows bow hunting. Pump the passion for the sport. Are you doing all you can? As always, I shared what I was doing instead of telling others what they should do. The number one thing anybody could see was that if I set a goal, I was committed 100%, physically and mentally, to be the very best I can be. My goal was gearing up to run the crazy tough 32.4-mile Bighorn Trail run in the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming and complete the run with my best ever ultramarathon finish. By the way, an ultramarathon is a race longer than 26 miles. My best before this race had been a sixth place finish at the 2006 Siskiyou Outback Trail Run, aka the SOB, in Ashland, Oregon. The byproduct of this goal for running the Bighorn, where I got second if memory serves, was to hopefully show those who might have the wrong impression of hunters that we are a passionate group of people. All the effort I expended in regard to conditioning was for bow hunting, period. If we are all heroes and heroines on quests and journeys like Joseph Campbell wrote about in The Hero with the Thousand Faces, we experience and accept that call to adventure. I had accepted mine when I decided to pursue bow hunting as a passion and to become the best hunter I could be. Eventually, we reach a point of no return where we must overcome any obstacles in our way that prevent us from moving forward. These can be deep-rooted fears or discouraging excuses that hold us back. Campbell calls this crossing the first threshold. The adventure is always and everywhere a passage beyond the veil of the known into the unknown. The powers that watch at the boundary are dangerous. To deal with them is risky. Yet for anyone with competence and courage, the danger fades. Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. When you're getting off the proverbial couch and out the proverbial door, it's easy not to want to venture further into the unknown, knowing that whatever comes is going to be more difficult. I had done this when I began to bow hunt, and I continued to do this when I began backcountry bow hunting on my own after Roy moved. Now it's pushing myself further with running longer distances. Ultramarathons? What was I thinking? I stood at the gateway where, just beyond it, as Campbell wrote, exists darkness, the unknown, and danger. Of course, something like that excited me. Nobody else might understand this except Roy Roth. No mountain is too high, and no challenge is too great, and danger is a non-factor. Roy, while not a runner like me, clearly understood the spirit residing in my soul that spurred me on to compete in the Bighorn Trail Run. I was ready. I began the race with a plan. My goal is to go out hard and try to break the other runners by hammering out the first 14 miles, which included some tough ascents up to 9,000 feet and brutal descents on game trails. Jumping over logs, slipping through the mud, sloshing through snow, this section had it all. I went down hard twice, tripping on the steep downhill and flying like Superman, except not really flying. I was skidding down the hill over rocks, sticks, and mud with my arms out. That last part was like Superman. It ended up being very wet up there, so my shoes were soaking and muddy and remained like that for the entire 32-mile run. This was hard on my feet as wet conditions softened the skin. I had lots of painful blisters for most of the run. This ultra had me hurting and more banged up than I'd ever been on a run. I moved into first place at about mile 7, as we were running on an elk trail and must have spooked a herd. There were fresh tracks running down the trail. This gave me a shot of motivation. I was in my element. This part of the race took me back to the times when I had to hustle to head off a herd of elk while in the wilderness. I envisioned myself running with my bow down the trail, casting glances through the dark timber for any sign of elk. It was awesome, and I knew that after passing the guy who had been leading, he was going to be a non-factor. A bow hunter running in some of Wyoming's best elk country was a tough guy to beat. This section included a long 5-mile uphill stretch, where the runners behind me would be able to see me from a great distance. I made it a point to hammer out this section as hard as I could, hoping their spirits would say that I was unbeatable. Damn, that Under Armour guy from Oregon is a machine. This race is for second. I arrived at the top of the hill after completing the 14-mile section with at least a 4 or 5 minute lead. Perfect. I grabbed a few goodies, shed my shirt since it was warming up fast, and was off. The bad part about hammering out that portion was that my quads and calves were on fire. I had to be on stage, though. There were still 18 miles left. I needed to pretend that it was all good to squash the hopes of the guys behind me, who were no doubt looking for a sign I was spent. Any sign, like hands on the head, bent over, hands on knees, whatever. My plan worked. Almost. I led the race until mile 24 or 25. The problem was, the race didn't end at mile 24 or 25. I stopped at an aid station to refuel, feeling like crap. I had stomach issues and wondered if it could have been the altitude. Living at sea level, I wasn't accustomed to running at 9,000 feet. I even ended up hurling a couple times post-race. Two runners zipped in and grabbed some stuff and were gone before I was. There were spirits already broken in this ultra, but it wasn't theirs. I kept hammering away, catching the guy for second, but never reaching the winner. It was no wonder. He was an endurance machine. Matt Hart out of Seattle, Washington. He was slated to run a 100-mile race, but decided to run my race instead. I wish he would have run the 100. My good friend and bow hunting mentor Dwight Shue ran the same Bighorn race in his first ever ultra, and he picked a tough one. At 62 years old, he was no doubt in his prime. When the gun went off, we all started together, and Dwight was on his way. 6 hours and 51 minutes and 37 seconds later, he broke the finish line after a great and noteworthy run. He looked like a stud out there, a real mountain ultra runner. Guy Eastman, who came over the hill to film, and I were very impressed with how strong Dwight looked. He inspired and motivated many to believe they can achieve more as he placed third in his age group. I finished second overall with a time of 4 hours and 53 seconds. It was a great day to be alive. Despite the misery on the run, I felt so grateful to have the ability to run the mountains. It gave me so much confidence for my true passion of bow hunting. Both disciplines are so similar. They are very difficult, and there are many mental battles that go on over the course of a race or a hunt. In both, success finds those that prepare the most, work the hardest, and are the strongest mentally. On almost all the races I run, at some point or another, I want to stop and throw in the towel. Similarly, on many tough hunts, I want to quit and go home to the good life, to my family. Mountain hunting had made me tough, and that helped me on the runs. The runs made me tough in another way, and that helped me in the mountains. So why don't I quit? What resides in me to keep going? Maybe it's because I don't want to let people down. Because I'm a regular guy, coming from a regular small town, who dared to dream about being special and finding some success in life. Maybe I've always felt like proving people wrong. As I started running marathons, I realized a connection between endurance racing and hunting. Because in both disciplines, you are facing huge barriers that make you want to quit. Nobody's going to judge you if you quit on a hunt. Most people fail on a hunt. The same goes for an ultramarathon. Not many could call you a failure if you didn't last to the finish of a long ultra. Because most people you know likely wouldn't even toe the starting line. But to me, failure feels like all those people who've doubted me over the years were right. I can't have that. All I thought about was success. All I trained for was to do whatever it took to succeed against all odds and circumstances. It's all mental. I say this all the time, and it's true. If you believe you can do it, you can. We all have virtually limitless potential. Our bodies are capable of so much more than what we ask of them. Take off the mental handcuffs, get out there, and start on your way today. What is your passion? You can become better at it. Committing yourself to fitness only fuels your beliefs. You gotta believe to achieve. How can you grow and push yourself? There are so many ways to become better at your craft, to build on your strengths. Not everybody has to go run a marathon in pursuit of their passion. Maybe you need to read and embrace the history of your endeavor or reach out to the masters in your niche. Running marathons taught me how to break those barriers inside of myself when I wanted to quit. What is the marathon you can find in your life? Find a way to endure and test your passion. Preparing for the pack out. I haven't been good at much throughout life, but getting animals on the ground by arrow is one area I've been able to experience long-term success. The hunt doesn't end there, however. Packing the meat from your kill out of the mountains comes next. Killing bulls with a bow is a ridiculously hard challenge on its own, but right behind that is breaking down the bull. This is hard work I love and live for. Regardless of how it may appear to those who don't hunt or don't hunt the backcountry anyway, there is an art to butchering a bull in the field. But art or not, it's a process I'm addicted to. You start by getting the hide off, then the quarters. Continue with the neck meat, back straps, rib meat, and tenderloins. Finally, the cape and head are pulled off. Your best bet is to hang the meat in the dark timber, thicker, bigger, and closed canopy of trees, on the north side of the draw to keep the meat cool as you pack it out quarter by quarter, which is work that takes time. You want to hang the quarters so the air can flow around them, helping to glaze the meat. Also, you want to make it at least halfway hard for bears to get to the meat. But with any luck, you won't be away for long between pack trips or to fetch pack animals. If you are, because a pack out and turnaround can take hours, leave a shirt or coat with your scent on it as a deterrent. This will cause most predators to shy away until you've returned for another heavy pack or to load up the panniers. If you have animals or friends or family members to help you, then you have the ability to potentially pack out the meat in hours in one trip. But otherwise, you have to quarter it and make several trips yourself. I train daily for these exact moments, packing out heavy loads of wild game meat for miles from the big game animals I kill with one perfectly placed arrow. That is, if the plan works. This is why I don't get the head shakers, the guys who are overly critical of training for hunting by saying physical conditioning has little or nothing to do with killing big game. Our bodies and minds are tools to use in the woods, and training hones those tools, simple as that. The better the tools you pack into the mountains, pack, sleeping bag, stove, bow, binoculars, body, mind, the more success you'll have. So I prepare. Running thousands of miles a year in the mountains to build endurance, lifting thousands of pounds of weight in the off-season to build strength, shooting a minimum of 15,000 arrows total in advance of bow season to build confidence in my craft. This process gives my life purpose and direction. I put in the work because that's what I'm good at. This work results in success for me and puts a smile on my face, even when there's a heavy load on my shoulders. I'm thankful bow hunting allows me to be the provider I was born to be. Chapter 8. Believe to achieve. Anything is possible. You can be told that you have a 90% chance, or a 50% chance, or a 1% chance. Whatever it is, you have to believe, and you have to fight. Lance Armstrong. I dreamt this so clearly, so precisely, and so frequently that it has manifested itself into reality. Conor McGregor. My performance predates this quote by Mystic Mac, but his mindset is exactly what I tried to emulate in 2008. Believe it, then achieve it. I think of this as I spot him around mile 7 of the Boston Marathon. He's in the middle of a big group of runners wearing a gold jersey. There he is. That's him. In 2008, I ran my first Boston Marathon, a dream I'd held for a while. What marathoner doesn't dream of the Boston Marathon? Shortly before the race, I learned that famed American cyclist Lance Armstrong would be competing in the marathon as well, so I was excited and told my kids about it. I'm going to find Lance in Boston and run with him for a while, I said to my boys, Tanner and Truett. Maybe someone will take a photo of us. I just want one. And then if I have anything left at the end, I'll push as hard as I can and sneak over the finish line just ahead of him. My kids smiled and laughed when I said this. You actually think you can beat Lance Armstrong? Tanner asked. We'd watched him for years dominate the Tour de France on TV, so the boys knew of his superhero status. You're just a dad, Truett added. He's Lance. I understood their disbelief. Lance Armstrong was an icon and an endurance racing legend. While he was fairly new to marathons at the time, he was an Olympic medal winner, 7-time Tour de France champion, and the greatest endurance athlete of all time. Back then, he was not only my hero, but almost everyone else's too. Performing on the bike was one thing, but his greatest claim to fame may have been beating an advanced form of testicular cancer that had also spread to his lungs and brain, which was potentially fatal. A couple years earlier in 2006, I ran another race with Lance, this time the New York City Marathon. I finished in 2 hours, 50 minutes, and 21 seconds, averaging about 6 minutes and 30 seconds per mile for 26.2 miles. That time I passed Lance at about the 1 mile mark and never saw him again. As someone who looked up to Lance and loved watching him race in the Tour de France every year, I was thrilled to beat the greatest ever in an endurance event. Of course, it wasn't really a race between us, but everyone knew Lance and wanted to feign a race one way as it might be. By 2008, Lance was training hard and really coming into his own as a marathoner. At a marathon leading up to Boston, he ran faster, 2 hours and 46 minutes, than I ever have for 26.2 miles. His goal for Boston was getting in the 240s. Race day in Boston is Patriots Day, the third Monday in April, which in my estimation made the 240s too lofty for me at that stage of my training for the year. I was coming off of show season, and a lot of travel makes it difficult to get in the miles. Plus, I'm just a backcountry bowhunter from Oregon, 4 years Lance's senior. The numbers don't really add up for my dream to come true, but that wouldn't stop me from visualizing what would actually come to pass. At the start of the Boston Marathon, I saw Lance way up ahead on the line with the elite runners. There were thousands of people between us, so I had some work to do to catch up to him. But I was feeling good, more confident than normal, and sure enough, 7 miles into the race, I had Armstrong in my sights. I couldn't believe it. I caught up to his group and settled in at their pace. I was running a little slower than I normally start, but then again, I always start too fast, blow up, and find myself scratching, clawing, and hurting like hell just to finish. I'm not a smart marathoner. Lance's pacers were dialing him right in on a steady pace. I figured, unlike me, they likely had a solid strategy. At about mile 14, we started to get into some hills. From what I could tell, Lance's pacers were gone, but he was still hammering away. He was a monster going up the hills. There was no way I could keep up his pace. I was hurting bad and starting to beat myself up. I can't believe I have the chance to run with Lance, and now I'm letting him pull away, leaving me back with the masses of runners. Faceless, nameless strangers to me. I have nothing left. Nothing. Hopefully somebody got a picture of me with him somewhere along the way. This was one of those moments in life, those defining moments we look back to, when we had a choice to make. When we have to decide to either give up or keep on going. Lance knew all too well about those sort of moments as he wrote about them in his book from the year 2000. It's not about the bike. My journey back to life. Pain is temporary and may last a minute or an hour or a day or a year, but eventually it will subside and something else will take its place. If I quit, however, it lasts forever. I was just about ready to throw in the towel, thinking I had given it all I had. Self-doubt started to seep in. I fixate on his calves hammering away in front of me. God, why couldn't I have been an Olympic athlete? Well, I couldn't have had that kind of talent. I'm no different from anyone else. Some days it's hard. My body hurts, my spirit wavers, and my mind is weak. During those times, it would be a lot easier to go home and chill out, but I never do. I always show up and grind it out, so that's what I decided to do. Armstrong once said in an interview on CNN, "I believe that the mind powers a body, and once the mind says we want to do it, then the body will follow." I want this. I'm going to give it all I've got. I'm going to catch up with Lance. If I puke or pass out or whatever, at least I'll be going down in flames. Running as hard as I could, I picked up my pace to try to close the gap. My legs didn't have much snap and they felt heavy, but by God, I was slowly catching up. Sure as anything, I started feeling a little better. I couldn't believe it. I was back on Lance's heels just in time for the toughest hills on the course. He powered up them, leaving me a little. But when we topped out and I caught back up, it seemed as if I could run the downhills easier than he could. At about mile 19, we climbed a fairly substantial grade, and Lance asked me a question. "Was that Heartbreak Hill?" "No," I tell him. "Heartbreak is still a couple miles out, mile 21. "Then what the hell was that?" "I don't know, but it hurt." "How are you feeling?" I asked as we steadily moved together. "I'm fucking dying," Lance said. Thank God, I thought, because I'm dying too. But this gives me hope. Misery loves company. We stayed together, or close, exchanging a few short comments back and forth along the way as we clicked off the miles. Running got easier then. I definitely had my second wind. "Hey, I lost my pacers," he said. "How fast are you going to run today?" "Probably 250, I say. "I'll just stay with you if you don't care." "Yeah, that's cool." Understatement of my life. The fans were loud, amazingly loud, and almost deafening. They saw Lance coming and went crazy. He had been one of the most recognizable faces in the world at the time, which had people in a frenzy. At the water stations, each volunteer excitedly tried to be the one to hand Lance a cup of water. I heard fans lining the course yelling, "Lance!" 10,000 times as we ran through the city. It was surreal. I ran beside a legend, beside someone who'd inspired millions all over the world. That man overcame so much. He stared death in the face and battled back to be the very best. It was a beautiful day in Boston. For the last few miles, there was a motorcycle with a cameraman on the back, filming every one of Lance's steps. Fans were reaching out, and I wondered if it reminded him of the tour. As we came around the corner, nearing the finish line, I told myself, well, here we go. Lance had his own finish line and a tape to break for the cameras, so we drifted apart. Then I dug deep and immersed myself in the pain. Amazingly, I ended up coming in 12 seconds ahead of Lance. My time? 2 hours, 50 minutes, 46 seconds. After the race, there was a moment when Lance pointed to me. As crazy as it sounds, it felt like we sort of formed a pseudo bond while running the marathon. I pointed back, then headed over and shook his hand, telling him it was an honor to run with him. Not sure he'd even remember me, but I'll never forget that day and that special marathon. After the race, I hustled off to the airport